Many of you may have seen the news from, I don't know, a week and a half ago or so that one of our country's very important writers, Tom Wolfe, died at the age of 88. He's a journalist, a novelist, author of such books as The Electric Kool-Aid Acid Test, The Bonfire of the Vanities, My Name is Charlotte Simmons, among others. Wolfe was unsparing as a cultural observer and critic of American life. I remember as a young adult being enthralled with that page-turner of his, The Right Stuff, which was a history of the Mercury space program and then later made into a feature film. And truth be told, I think I have some affinity for Tom Wolfe as a fellow Virginian. He went to an Episcopal boys school in Richmond, from which my uncles and now two nephews have graduated. And a familiar sight, I am told, in these last decades on New York City's Upper East Side in his iconic white or cream-colored suit. In 1975, he wrote a book called The Painted Word that was a biting satire of modern art, or more specifically, modern art criticism and theory. In Wolfe's eyes, art critics had strangely become more influential than art and artists. And then he imagines a museum of the future where art would be about the size of a postage stamp, and next to it would be these blown-up posters with explanations of the art. Real art overwhelmed by art theory. And I wonder sometimes if the church can be like that. I wonder sometimes if you wonder sometimes if preaching can be like that. The reality of the gospel diminished by pedantic, overly teachy explanations of the gospel. If ever that were a possibility, I'm afraid to say it is today. For this particular celebratory Sunday in the church here is called Trinity Sunday. Today is the day we mark, we honor, we wrestle with the doctrine of the Holy Trinity. And as you know, the Holy Trinity is Christianity's most unique and important theological claim. God is three, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. And yet, God is one. How do we make sense of that? How do we work that out? The harder we try to work that out, to explain it, I have observed sometimes that the more abstract and remote God seems to become. Exactly the opposite of what the doctrine is meant to articulate. That we have a personally loving, relational, real God who always and everywhere and forever seeks to draw us into communion. The development of this central doctrine of the church, the Trinity, was a bumpy one and not without controversy over several centuries, but really I think it emerged out of the missionary nature of the early church. As the Christian movement spread around the Mediterranean basin to the west, outward from Jerusalem, and as it spread eastward as well, it made contact with a Gentile world that had a variety of very different conceptions of God. As you know, the God of the Hebrew Bible, the Old Testament, is intimately involved with his world, with people, with the particular people, Israel, acting in their affairs, acting in history, passionate about what is going on. And that kind of God was utterly foreign to pagan gods in the Greco-Roman culture. Those pagan gods were defined essentially in the opposite way. Immune from the goings-on of the world, indifferent, merely over and above us. For example, you might remember somewhere in school studying Aristotle. In Aristotle's God is essentially perfect rationality of some eternal nature, utterly beyond the realm of physical experience. So how do you get people like that, whether in ancient Rome or ancient Egypt, ancient Syria or ancient Persia, to come to know a personal, historical, intimate, dying, rising, forgiving, and loving God, who at the same time is creator of the whole universe. And how do you get Episcopalians to know that God as well? Well, the answer is that you don't approach it as a conceptual problem to solve or a theological complexity to explain. I want to avoid the blown up poster next to the postage stamp. We get at it by analogy, illustrations. Church has always tried to do that in talking about the Holy Trinity. We get at it by telling stories. And all people through all time, across all cultures, have learned best by entering into stories. Every good illustration, analogy, or story, however, of the Trinity must begin with this presupposition. And it is this: we would never in a million years figure out how to get to God, who God is, on our own. Have to get that first. It is God who reveals, God who takes the initiative. It is God's power who opens this up, draws us in to know personally, to have experience personally, to have communion in the Godhead. But how? Again, how can we know God? I'm struck that the church pairs this day with that passage from the gospel about Nicodemus, because I've said before, preaching on that story, that Nicodemus reminds me of somebody from St. George's. He's a successful and he's prominent. He's a good person. He's trying to be a good religious man. And Jesus says to him, that isn't going to do it. You're never going to get to God if you think that's religion. He says, you need to be born from above. Your achievements, your insights, your practices will never be enough to know who God really is. You need to be born from above. So, story. I think it was about 4 or 5 years ago, we hosted the very last of our C3 conferences here at St. George's, and we had among our guests a Christian writer and theologian named Baxter Kruger. And he sat right up here in one of the sessions and taught us, and he shared a very simple, ordinary kind of story. But as soon as I heard him tell it, I thought to myself, I will never forget that. And I'll tell you why in just a second. Kruger is a native Mississippian from South Mississippi. But with his wife, he went to Scotland in Aberdeen, where he got his PhD. After getting his doctorate, he returned to the States. He returned to Mississippi. He has a young family now, a young son and a young daughter. And he tells a story about one Saturday afternoon, sitting on his couch, sifting through some junk mail and waiting for a particular college football game to come on and watch. And out of the corner of his eye, he saw some movement. What he saw was two camouflaged little boys sneaking into the room, hiding behind a chair. Two little boys, camouflaged hats, little children's army uniforms, plastic guns, and grenades. Before he could process what was happening, he saw a camouflaged blur fly into the room, land on him, his son, and a friend on a dangerous mission. Suddenly, the three of them were enveloped in mortal hand-to-hand combat, wrestling on the couch, falling on the floor, laughing, screaming, jumping, running around. Kruger said that he was killed and resurrected about 3 or 4 times in that battle. And after about 5 minutes, they all stand up, panting, laughing, looking at each other. And Kruger says that in that moment, he heard a voice in his soul say, Baxter, pay attention to this. Pay attention to this. Okay, but pay attention to what? He responded in his spirit. A dad, a son, horseplay on a Saturday afternoon. This must be happening all over the country. Then it hit him. It hit him. Baxter said he did not know who this other little boy was. He'd never seen him before. He did not know him. He did not know his name. That little boy had never seen him before. And Kruger then imagined a different kind of scenario than the one that played out. Suppose this nameless friend of his son had come over to the house that Saturday afternoon, and they'd been playing, and then he had gotten separated from Kruger's son and wandered into the den on his own and looked up and seen Dr. Kruger sitting on the couch. He might have assumed he was his friend's father, but he wouldn't have been sure. But he would never in a million years have flown across the room and jumped on Baxter Kruger and played around and laughed and carried on like that with that sort of familiarity. Because that little boy did not know this father, Dr. Kruger. He would not know how Kruger would react, how he would engage him. He might get mad at him. He did not know that father's heart. But Kruger's own son, he knew his father's heart. And Kruger's son showed that heart to his friend. And you can imagine how it might have gone. Hey, I got an idea. Let's sneak up on my dad and jump on him and have war with him. He loves that kind of stuff. I know him. He loves this stuff. Come on. And his friend trusted the son. He trusted the son's relationship to the father. The power, the reality of the love between that father and that son who knew each other's hearts. Well, it was powerful enough to draw the other little boy in as well. God did not send the Son into the world to condemn the world, but that the world might be saved through him. I mean, don't you see this now? All the work of Christ, his being born, his living and teachings, his death and his resurrection and his ascension were that Son saying, I know my Father, and he loves this, and he will love it with you. I told you, as soon as I heard Kruger tell that story, I knew I would never forget it because it reminded me so very much of my own daddy. How many times did we roll around on the den floor wrestling, and he always started it. And he always let me win, and my brothers would join in. And what I remembered specifically when he told the story was that there was a point in my childhood when one of my really good friends, Chris, stayed with us for several days because his parents had gone out of town. And I remember we were doing that, and Chris was kind of standing there looking at us. Am I okay in this relationship? And he jumped in. Today, on this Trinity Sunday, we hear one of the most extraordinary things that St. Paul ever wrote in his letter to the Romans. I want you to hear it again. For all who are led by the Spirit of God are children of God. For you did not receive a spirit of slavery to fall back into fear, but you have received a spirit of adoption. You see, the Spirit draws you into that loving embrace, wrestling match of the Father and the Son. And Paul goes on, when we cry, Abba, Father, it is that very Spirit bearing witness with our spirit that we are children of God. And if children, then heirs with God and joint heirs with Christ. Which is a way of saying that the love that the Father has for Jesus, because of Jesus, is open to us. And the Spirit leads us in, again, to this heart knowledge that the Father and the Son have for each other and want to have with us. There is no other religion that makes such a claim, not even close. Our God is Daddy, Papa, Abba, Father. The Son reveals this. The Spirit draws us in so that, again, the love the Father has for the Son and the love the Son has for the Father envelops us here now, and it's our love too and our life. Jesus just wants us to know this, to get this, to have this love and life, what we might call the Holy Trinity, as a lived reality that envelops us all. Jesus did not come to give us information. Jesus did not come to give us explanations. Jesus did not come to give us practices. Jesus, therefore, did not come to give us religion. Jesus came to give us relationship. That is to say, Jesus came to give us communion. Communion with himself, that he has with the Father. And by the Spirit we would know that we are taken into that, adopted as sons and daughters. And that's not a theory of the Holy Trinity. That is the gospel.